Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And it's just us tonight. Chris Bernor and Davinder Hardwar are off doing wonderful, spectacular things in the world of tech. Or actually, I think they're both decompressing from their wonderful, spectacular, exciting days in the world of tech. So
yeah, it's true. Davinder was tuckered out.
Yeah. Too much. Sometimes there can be too much tech. So we're flying solo here, and we're coming to you live here on geeksofdoom.com, as we do every week. And this week, on this week's show, we're going to take a look at the various flavors of Microsoft's upcoming Windows 8 OS and Twitter's vow to stay out of the patent wars. But first, we have a full list of headlines on this week's show. We might as well just crack into them. So Google just announced plans to create a new class of non-voting capital stock, which is effectively a stock split. It's the first stock split in Google's history, and co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin wrote a letter explaining their situation. They said the new shares will be non-voting shares and will help the co-founders maintain control over the company. They said in their letter, maintaining the founder-led approach is in the best interests of Google, our shareholders, and our users. It's effectively a two-for-one stock split, something many of our investors have long asked us for. These non-voting shares will be available for corporate uses, like equity-based employee compensation, that might otherwise dilute our governance structure. So I have to admit that I know very little about stock and stock splits, but it seems to me that what this is saying is you can invest in our company, you just can't have control of it.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. I was a little worried when they first did the stock split. I was worried that, you know, they were kind of going the way of those 90s companies and just kind of, you know, split it all up. But what I found is that with this situation, what they've been doing, they've actually basically said, look, new stock and, you know, this new non-voting stock, it's not going to get in the way of our founder-based approach. You're not going to have, you know, some people from the outside, minority shareholders, sit back and say, hey, look, we want you to make some stupid change that'll make us money in the short term for the next quarter for quarterly growth because we're stockholders and that's how we're about. They're like, no, we're founders. It's a founder approach. We have a long view. We have a long vision. And as much as we want you to take part in our success through stock, we have to make the decisions. And part of the gamble you're taking when you buy the stock is to trust us. This is a brilliant move on Google's part.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. No. I'm not an investor of Google, but this initially would make me a little nervous because, I mean, you can still purchase the other kind of stock, can't you? The other class.
It's unclear to me. I think you can, but it is unclear to me. I haven't looked into it that much. I feel like the big point here is that a bunch of people got their stock split, so the value is the same, but they have two pieces of stock now, and you know the new stock is non-voting,
right?
Which is, you know, it also keeps them, it insulates them somewhat from hostile takeovers.
Yes, yeah. Now that much seems clear, that they're definitely trying to protect the way they run the company by diluting the stock by doing the stock split. Let's move on here. Google is planning to release their version of basically Google Drive, which is kind of like their version of something like a Dropbox. And they're going to drop that next week. And they're planning to start everyone with 5 gigabytes of storage, which trumps Dropbox's 2 gigabytes.
And it is exactly equal to Apple's iCloud 5 gigabytes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, and they have plenty, they have that storage to spare. I mean, Google's just bleeding storage all over the place.
Exactly.
And what's interesting is the wording related to how the system will work. It's been long thought that Windows integration will come easy, but getting the Google Drive icon into the Mac, like Dropbox, would be a bit harder. And from what I've been reading here, Google Drive will work in desktop folders in both Mac and Windows machine, which still leaves how they're going to do it unanswered. But we're going to, you know, this is something that is going to be dropping next week, and we're going to be covering it. I'm sure when it actually does drop next week, we'll cover it in depth. But for now, we just have a little bit of rumors going on, so we're not entirely sure what's going. What do you think about the idea of Google Drive in general, Dwayne?
I think it's, I mean, everyone's wanted it forever, right? We've had all this space on Gmail, his drive. It's not, you know, it's not all Gmail space, but it's 5 gigs. I think it's great. I think a lot of people who haven't experienced the joy of Dropbox will get something similar in this. And given that Zumo Drive just got turned off for all these users, I feel like this is a good opportunity for Dropbox to feel a little bit of competitive pressure. It is kind of a copycat thing on one level, which I'm not so happy about, but that actually remains to be seen because we don't know how they're going to implement it. And I think that's really important. The implementation, you know, it's a good way to get people thinking about storage on the cloud. I think people trust Google.
Can I ask you, what do you use your Dropbox for?
I use it for a few things. I have a folder in there called Sorting Hat, and whenever I throw stuff, if I'm on a work computer or another computer, and I throw stuff in there, Hazel on my Mac will pull it out, and depending on what it is, like put it where it's supposed to be on my Mac. So that's pretty fun. And then I use it for like all my tax stuff is hanging out in Dropbox for worse. All my all the stuff I kind of want to be able to get to no matter where I am. But I haven't had to. I don't pay for Dropbox. I just have a 6 gigabyte account based on the fact that I got a whole bunch of friends to sign up a long time ago.
Oh, nice. I have Dropbox as well, and I hardly ever use it for anything, so I'm not entirely sure. Maybe I'm just not utilizing the cloud as efficiently or as well as I should.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because I don't know how Google's going to do it, but the Dropbox, it you know, as much as it's cloud, it's also on that drive. So
right.
It's kind of always available offline, which is very nice. So it's cloud, but it's not restrictive in the cloud way. And I think that's why they took off so well.
All right, let's move on here. On a call to discuss Yahoo's first quarter earnings Tuesday, Scott Thompson, their CEO, said that they're going to begin by shutting down some 50 properties they deem inessential and consolidating redundant technology platforms. They're going to refocus their media network around the core areas of sports, news, entertainment, and finance, and moving more of their engineers into commerce-based businesses and refocusing their R&D resources on owned and operated businesses rather than on platforms that serve outside publishers. I can certainly see where Yahoo could use some trimming down, and there are a lot of properties that are non-essential. I just hope that when I hear that they're going to refocus around the core areas of sports, news, entertainment, and finance, I don't feel like I'm seeing photo sharing in there anywhere, which sounds to me like that this could be the end of Flickr. I don't know. Am I being paranoid about that?
I don't think you're being paranoid, but it's definitely, I mean, they've been quiet about that. Flickr's really powerful. It's really surprising that they wouldn't want to support that. But who knows what they mean when they say repetitive? Do they mean Facebook's doing pictures so we don't have to do it? Or do they mean that there's something else in Yahoo's system that's doing photos? I'm sad if Flickr's going away. I'm just kind of hanging out with bated breath and hoping that we'll see some clarity in this. I do like the fact that they're learning how to focus. I think we talked about focus a lot last episode.
Mm-hmm.
And the more Yahoo focuses on their media business, the more I think they can get back in the game, so to speak, with tech. So we'll see.
Our buddy over at VentureBeat, Tom Cheridar, co-wrote an article about called 10 Yahoo Services That Should Be Killed, but that should be killed by Scott Thompson's restructuring plan. And he outlines a few services that he feels deserve the chop. I'm just going to list a few off here. Messenger chat, connected TV, Yahoo Maps, Yahoo Upcoming, Into Now. I don't even know what Into Now is. Live Stand, Avatars, Yahoo Answers. Now, I thought Yahoo Answers is kind of entertaining.
I thought it was dead. I thought it was dead a while ago.
Maybe it is. Message boards and forecast. Forecast, once again, I'm not sure what that is, but it seems like some of these seem a little repetitive. Like forecast, I'm looking at the description of this, and it seems to be similar, very similar to Yahoo Answers. So I can definitely see the need to consolidate a lot of these services at the very least.
Yeah, I think they're spread too thin. It's sad that they even got this far, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm glad that they're. I don't think they need the Maps program at all. I don't think anyone really uses it, especially when they have that relationship with Microsoft. Throw in Bing Maps. You've already got Bing Search, and focus on your content. Focus on Yahoo Sports, which is very powerful. Focus on hopefully Flickr. You know the drill.
Yeah. All right, moving on here. This week, Valve Software set the world of gaming news abuzz by attempting to hire hardware engineers. And now, the Valve programmer Michael Abrash has revealed what kind of hardware the company is prototyping. Computer technology you can wear. It's certainly an important time to admit such a thing, considering how Google's Project Glass heads-up display generated so much interest last week. But Abrash cautions that you shouldn't expect a product out of Valve anytime soon, if at all. He writes, "To be clear, this is R&D. It doesn't in any way involve a product at this point, and it won't for a long time, if ever. So no rumors about Steam glasses being announced at E3. The Valve approach is to do experiments and see what we learn. Failure is fine just as long as we can identify failure quickly, learn from it, and move on, and apply it to the next experiment. The process is very fast-moving and iterative, and we're just at the start." So, Dwayne, what do you think about Steam glasses?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. There's kind of no there. They've got like some hardware guys. They're doing some R&D. They're looking at wearable computing, whether it's like, I don't know, like a watch that plays games or something like that. I don't know, but I feel like I've always trusted Valve. I've always looked at what Valve has had to say, and they don't really. I don't remember them really screwing up. You know. They kind of take the long view, you know, the whole Steam thing, you know, Counter-Strike, all these great titles. So I feel like, you know, they're kind of like, okay, we've done this game thing. We've got this on lock. Let's use some of the money to subsidize, you know, new and emerging products. And it's kind of what we need to see more in tech. Like if Yahoo had been doing this successfully, they wouldn't be in the position they were in, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, really, yeah.
So as long as they don't go crazy and spend all their money researching some, you know, weird nonsense, I think it's going to be good for tech, and the enthusiasts are going to be there. They already love this company.
Absolutely. I think you're right about the point that they haven't really failed, because I mean, I think with their games, with their individual games, they take so much time to develop them, you know, and they have the resources and the time to just keep working at it until they get it right, you know, release it when it's ready, not when it's not to hit any sort of schedule date. And the same goes for Steam. You know, the game distribution service has just been wildly successful. And the fact that they have these sales all the time just inspire people to want to, you know, to want to invest their money into Steam games. So like they haven't been able, they really haven't had a misstep. So I feel like if they just take that same approach in creating whatever this is going to be, I mean, we're assuming glasses, but we don't really know. I mean, it could be like a version of the Nintendo Power Glove, you know, something that you put on and play Steam games with. I have no idea, but whatever it is, I think it's going to be successful.
Let's hope it's more successful than the Nintendo Power Glove.
Speaking of jumping in to companies jumping in to products to appliances, IKEA is entering a brave new world with home entertainment systems. This week they unveiled their Uplava line with a smart with the smart YouTube ad, which we're going to put in the show notes to show you. The ad explains that the Uplava line is a savior to living rooms everywhere with hidden cable tracks, integrated wireless components, and customizable cabinet design. They said that the HDTV itself is going to be a 1080p LED LCD screen with a 400 hertz response time and some sort of smart TV functionality. But the HDTV really doesn't matter. Even though it has the specs of a high-end screen, IKEA could have employed a mid-range model and still made the same sort of magic here. I think that they their savvy understanding of integration is really smart, and I think this is the kind of thing. The brilliance of this of a unit like this is that there are tons of hardcore electronic geeks like you and I who are very particular about the units that we bring into our house, you know, our main viewing units. But there are even more, there are scores of people who just want something that works right and looks nice in their home. And I think that they fill this niche market.
Yeah, it's at first I was like, what? And then I looked at it again and I'm like, well, how many hours did I spend concealing cables when I got my TV? The 5.1 surround sound is being housed against this thing that goes against my moldings and you can't tell that it's there. And yeah, it took forever. If IKEA can pull off something that serves half of that, just the feature of cables coming out of the back of the television and going directly into wherever your media devices are, that's huge, especially for that guy or that girl who's like, hey, honey, I really want this. Like, I really want a new TV. I really want something in that. There are other significant others. Like, I want it neat. I don't care what it is. I just don't want it expensive, and I want it neat, which I think is huge. So, I mean, you listen to, like, Sony complain that they're not making any money off their TVs. You see all these models around. You think, IKEA, okay, it's probably all the same television set, but I have a choice in how I want to house that television set. Yeah. I know all those housing things will work. And it'll have basically the smart features that I want. When we say smart, you know, like Netflix integration is probably a given. Sure. You know, Hulu's always up in the air. But, you know, Netflix integration, the ability to connect to some other device. Maybe there's like a, you know, LG supports a Plex box, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm really curious to see how this thing emerges. IKEA is really great at minimalism and integration. And for a lot of people, especially like people who like just straight up appliance type products and they don't want to get into the weeds, I think this is going to be pretty helpful for them.
Absolutely. And this is it's funny because we haven't seen like console based electronics that are integrated into furniture in, I would say, decades, you know, since the late 50s or the 60s. When TVs used to come in cabinets. When was the last time that you saw anything like this? And
I definitely saw, like, you know, maybe the 80s or whatever. But yeah, you're right. It was dwindling. It's kind of gone. I remember when my aunt got a special TV cabinet for her first HDTV back in like 98 or 99, you know, 2000. It was like a 1080, 720p. Like, it went back and it was flat in the front. We're like, whoa, this is so cool. And she had to get a special cabinet because the thing went back so far. Mm-hmm. So, and it costs a fortune. And I think that this is the kind of thing that, you know, IKEA is not really going to cost a fortune. They do have a high-end line and stuff, but they're not going to cost a fortune to get good quality stuff. And also, if you think about it, I mean, DaVinci would say TVs are something you replace every 5 years nowadays, whereas when I was a kid, you know, we had a TV for 10 years easy because the tech didn't change very often. As long as your Sony just lasted, you were fine. So I think this is going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah. It's not something that I can foresee myself, like, personally purchasing, because I am one of those guys who's very particular about the kind of display technology that comes into my home. But, like, for a spare bedroom or for, like, I can, I'm curious to see this. Like, I can see myself going to IKEA just to check this out and to check out the different configurations. Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, I mean, that's half the fun of going to IKEA. Well, when you get dragged there anyway.
Yeah. So next up, Dwayne, you dropped this link in our show notes about text messages that can soothe the disconnected soul.
Yeah, so this was really interesting to me. Kind of like a feel-good and kind of a counterintuitive to me based on what we've all read about technology, what we tend to think about technology. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, basically, University of Berkeley did some testing, and over the survey, mostly focused on people of Hispanic land descent, they found that when they sent automated text messages to people, sort of like irreverently, depending on when people received it, they felt better. To give you an example, I was in a difficult situation. I received a text message and asked me if you're okay. Just you okay? I felt cared for and supported. My mood instantly improved, even though the person, didn't know where it was coming from, or they knew that it was from a machine. You know what I mean?
How weird.
So it's interesting because we're such social beings that oftentimes – and we're really social beings, but at the same time, we often feel alone. In fact, a lot of the reason why technology is taking off in the way it does is because it helps us not feel alone. And despite the fact that text messages are often blamed for high cell phone bills and kids not paying attention when they should be paying attention, or people just not communicating face-to-face with themselves, it's just an interesting, weird little story about how just feeling as if you're being reached out to. Makes you better, makes you feel better.
You know, this doesn't surprise me at all, because I had heard in years past that they had done studies that showed that online psychiatry, like people going to online forums to discuss their mental health, is just as effective as going to a, you know, physical live psychiatrist. Like, they get the same sort of mental satisfaction and benefit from interacting with people online in a forum than they would from actually going to therapy.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't heard that, but it does make sense. People want to know that there's someone out there. I think that's kind of – it's just amazing that this happened. I don't really know why they focused on Latin people, though, I gotta say.
Maybe, like, that was so just what? The sample.
Yeah, the people that they had available.
All right. And the last headline here before we get into our main topic, before we go to our sponsor and then go into our main topic, is did you see, Dwayne, the footage from Coachella this last weekend, the Tupac appearance?
Yeah, I mean, I glanced at it. It was, you know, yeah.
Well, the webosphere is all abuzz with talks of Tupac's surprise appearance from the dead, as it were. He appeared as a hologram and did a duet with Snoop Dogg. People were, you know, all abuzz about how this technology was even possible. And
that's because he never really died. Him and Notorious B.I.G. are just hanging out in the Bahamas, and then they come back for a cameo every now and then, call it a hologram.
I think they're both of them are together laughing about all the conspiracy theories about their deaths.
Yeah. This was cool. I mean, I don't know if you remember this, but when Nat King Cole died, years after Nat King Cole died, His daughter, Natalie, she did a remake of the song Unforgettable, where they mixed her in with him.
Right.
He was long dead. And, you know, everyone was talking about how amazing it sounded, because it didn't really sound as if he was separate. Now, I don't know if it stands up to scrutiny. You listen to it today, you might think something different. But I think this is kind of the same thing. I like the idea that people are able to not have to lose connection and the real ability for, you know, the reason why Tupac was big wasn't just because he rapped. It was because he performed. And if they can capture any of that historically in a hologram, in right. anything, that's, you know, that's something for, you know, history.
And the reason I wanted to bring this article up was not just because it was so popular, but because it employs it turns out it's actually not a hologram per se, but it employs a technique known as Pepper's Ghost, which goes back to the 16th century. And I have to admit that I'm a huge fan of the Pepper's Ghost illusion because it's so simple, so easy to pull off, and so effective. You get the most bang for your buck. And basically what it amounts to is you project an image at a mirrored surface, and that mirrored surface reflects onto a half mirror, you know, or a glass that is semi, you know, that is half mirrored, half see-through and half not. And then it creates the illusion that whatever that projected image is floating in midair, because you can see through the glass, and yet there's this projection on it. And you see this this effect used a lot at amusement parks. Sometimes haunted houses will do it. I've seen it. You know, if you've ever been to Disneyland or Walt Disney World, in the haunted mansion.
Oh, it's so scary.
Yes, they have this. They have this whole room where you're watching ghosts dancing in this ballroom. That's the Pepper's Ghost illusion. That's effectively the exact same thing as this Tupac hologram. And we saw it in 2006 with Madonna and the Gorillaz. Effectively, this exact same implementation of this illusion, where Madonna was dancing, singing a duet with the Gorillaz on stage. And I just love it. I just love it because it's simple, it's easy to pull off, and it always has that wow factor, you know. And to think that an illusion that goes back to the 16th century can still wow us, can still impress us,
yeah,
and
it's pretty huge,
and cause buzz in 2012 is actually fairly impressive.
I was just talking about like Independence Day with Will Smith from '96, mm-hmm. with the Bridge and some other people, and we were like, yeah, the special effects, they don't stand up to time, unfortunately, because it's a funny movie, and you think to yourself, wow, this thing's been out since for the last, like, you know, almost 400 years, mm-hmm. and it still works. So mm-hmm. kudos to them.
All right, let's take a little break here to talk about our sponsor, which is Audible.com. And for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that I'd like to recommend this week is called 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, The Most Baffling Scientific Mysteries of Our Time. And science's best kept secret is that there are experimental results and reliable data that the most brilliant scientists can neither explain or dismiss. In the past, similar anomalies have revolutionized our world, as in the 16th century when a set of celestial anomalies led Copernicus to realize that Earth revolves around the sun and not in the reverse. And in the 1770s when two chemists discovered oxygen because of experimental results that defied the theories of the day. If history is any precedent, we should look to today's inexplicable results to forecast the future of science. In other words, if just because we can't explain it now doesn't mean that we won't be able to explain it in the future, and that explanation will result in the unveiling of the discovery of phenomenal scientific breakthroughs. So let me just play a little clip here from this book, which is written by Michael Brooks and narrated by James Adams.
Quantum theory encapsulated the novel idea that some things in nature are entirely random. This made no sense to Einstein or Bohr. To Bohr, it meant some things might be beyond the scope of science. To Einstein, it meant something was wrong with the theory. It was here, in this hotel, that Einstein made his famous remark that God does not play dice. Bohr's reaction faces up to scientists' biggest frustration, that they don't get to set the rules. Einstein, he said, stop telling God what to do.
So that was a small clip from 13 Things That Don't Make Any Sense, the most baffling scientific mysteries of our time, written by Michael Brooks, narrated by James Adams. And that book, amongst any others of any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, can be yours. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook or any others. And I believe it's 30-day trial now to give you a chance to check out their service. If you're not an Audible subscriber already, going to the address helps us out here on the show. So please feel free to do that. All right, we're going to take a little break here, but when we come back, we're going to talk about Windows 8 and Microsoft's schedule of Windows 8 releases and what each of those versions are going to, the significance of each of those versions. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Come with me. Hail Mary, run quick, see. What do we have here now? You wanna ride or die? I ain't a killer, but don't push me. Revenge is like the sweetest joy next to getting pussy. Picture paragraphs unloaded, wise words being quoted. Beat the weakness in the rap game and sold it. Bow down, pray to God, hoping that he's listening. Seeing niggas coming for me, my diamonds when they glistening. Now pay attention, rest me please, father. I'm a ghost, and this killing feels. Hail Mary, catch me if I go. Let's go deep inside the solitary mind of a madman. Screams in the dark, evil lurks, enemies see me flee. Activate my hate, let it break till I'm flaming. Set trip, empty out my clip, never stop to aim. Some say the game is all corrupted, fucked in this shit. Stuck, niggas is lucky if we bust out this shit. And plus, mama told me never stop until I bust a nut. Fuck the world if they can't adjust. It's just this way, oh, Hail Mary. Come with me. Hail Mary, nigga, run quick, see. What do we have here now? Do you wanna ride or die?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas.
Hey.
And let's talk about Microsoft and Windows 8. So Microsoft, this last week, they announced the main Windows 8 product lineup. And it's actually pared down quite a bit from previous versions. Do you remember back in like the Vista days or earlier when there would be like 7 different versions of Windows that you could purchase?
Yeah, even now where we're looking, like, you know, you're in Windows 7. There's Windows 7 Starter. I think there's Windows 7 Basic. Then there's Windows 7 Home Premium. Then there's Windows 7 Professional. And there's Windows 7 Enterprise. And then there's one more type of Windows 7, Ultimate. So you've got a whole bunch of different versions of an operating system. Right. And then you've got Windows Server, right? You have a whole bunch of different operating systems that are actually the same operating system. They're just stripped down service by service by service until they're able to, you know, basically like run on almost anything, which is why we have so many different Windows machines. And ever since they stopped selling the discs with the computers that you buy, it's kind of been a pain in the ass if you want to like just reinstall Windows and just, or upgrade Windows or whatever, because you can't always upgrade from one to another. You have to get the interim one, or you just have to like blow it all away. It's a lot of pain. It's a lot of pain in the ass.
It was so confusing.
Yeah, but this is one of the reasons why, despite the fact that I don't mind Windows for being Windows. When it comes to hardware, if I were to buy another laptop, I'd actually want to go pick up a Mac, only because even if I'm running Windows, I know with my HP, I get Windows on it, and I then have to go out and find all the drivers for, like, you know, the special buttons that, you know, make it the brightness higher or lower, or change the volume, or pause and play music, and HP makes me search for that. In fact, when I had to redo my laptop, getting the Bluetooth to work was amazing because I had amazingly difficult because I had to basically get a driver that tells the something like the Wi-Fi card to pretend to be a Bluetooth card. That wasn't. Yeah. I mean, other companies do that. In fact, I think Apple even does that. But the fact is, it's the driver's like a virtual thing. But the thing is, with Bootcamp, it all happens. Like, you don't have to think of it. There's one package, it gets distributed, it all works. And that's one of the things that, you know, as an HP user, I was jealous of, frankly, when it came to the Windows experience, which to me still has a lot of value.
So Microsoft announced that there's going to be just three versions of Windows total for this next version of Windows 8, and that is Windows 8, Windows 8 Pro, and Windows RT. Now, Windows 8, the differences are between Windows 8 and Windows 8 Pro are minimal. And Windows RT is specifically made for ARM hardware, which is basically your tablets or your smaller devices, like handheld.
Super netbooks or things like that.
Like super, super lightweight, ultra super netbooks. Ones that are designed for the ARM, what is it, high efficiency processor. And the differences are, let me see if I can rattle off some of the differences here. Windows RT is going to have touch-optimized desktop versions of Microsoft Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and OneNote built in. And it's going to have some sort of encryption, like hardware encryption, integrated into it. I'm looking at a list of a breakdown chart of Windows 8, Windows 8 Pro, and Windows RT. Windows 8 and 8 Pro, you can upgrade from Windows 7. Windows RT, obviously you can't, because I think Windows RT is going to be OEM only. It's going to be preloaded into that.
It ships with those devices. It's just like when you get an iPad, it ships, you know, the OS ships with the iPad. You don't install iOS 5 onto an iPad. You might upgrade it or something, but you don't install it. I think the idea with the RT is that it's designed for embedded devices, for these ARM devices, and embedded devices work very much like appliances, and you don't really install new OSs on appliances. So I think that's kind of what's going on here. It does come built in with a full version of Microsoft Office, though, which I think is the real kicker. So despite the fact that it has some restrictions, you can't install any other apps on it. You can't, when I say apps, I guess I mean Windows programs. You can't install any other like Windows desktop programs. You can only install the RT specific or the Metro based programs on it. A little sad, but it does come with that full version of Office. So if you're one of those people like me who uses Office at work all the time, and you're on the go, you're not sort of stuck using. I can use some apps to kind of mimic Office on my iOS devices, but it really isn't the same. And OpenOffice isn't where I needed to be to get anything really done productively. So it's going to be, I think, a big appeal because people are going to say things like, "I have a Windows phone. I mean, I have a Windows computer. Why am I going to get like an Android phone or an Android tablet when I can just get a Windows, you know, tablet that does all the stuff for me? Like, I open it up and my Office 365 documents and my Dropbox documents just work exactly as I thought they would." That kind of thing. So I think Microsoft has real potential here when it comes to moving this forward.
Yeah. More importantly is that they're making sure that Metro interface works on all of these versions, and in particular the RT version. Because I think that's, you know, really the way that they're going from here on out. We've discussed that before, like the death of the general computing desktop.
I think that Microsoft is going to be smart enough to maintain. I mean, who knows? This could be like, you know, what's the word? The transition period, right? Windows 8, and then by the time they're at Windows 10, you know, Windows X or whatever, it's all like, you know, appliance focused stuff. But yeah, this device clearly their answer to the iPad without jumping directly over to the focused tablet market. It's why they haven't been throwing Windows Phone, which is, you know, it's got the word phone in it, onto tablet type devices. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. I can't say I'm super excited to get my hands on one of these devices for myself, but I am super excited to play with it. And that's only because basically I've been sucked into when it comes to the integration that I have between like my iOS stuff and the fact that I bought all these iOS apps and things. But I really am interested to see how well it works on the productivity side, because I would definitely think about picking one of these up if on the productivity side it was powerful. And with the way Microsoft is doing this Windows 8 thing with the developers, we're going to see a ton of apps fly out on Metro. So it's interesting, and I think it's good because even Tim Cook said that there's a third horse in this race, and it's Microsoft, and booyah, you know.
Well, who was the second horse? He was.
Well, I think he was saying that, you know, it's not just the Android iOS world. Microsoft is coming. You know, kind of like Mordor. Yeah. It's on its way. It's coming from the west.
One does not just march into OS dominance, right?
Right. Exactly. So I think I mean, Microsoft is the comeback kid. Remember the browser, Internet Explorer was the dark horse, and they came out and took over everything for years, almost a decade. The GUI operating system, we talked about it last week. You know, Apple went to Xerox, Apple came back from Xerox. You know, then Windows showed up, and Apple's like, what? And then, you know, Microsoft just took off because they were able to get all these guys to make devices for them. So Microsoft is that, like, I'm going to keep it in the pocket. I'm going to study it. I'm going to figure out how to make it do well, like, you know, what I think is the best for the most amount of people, and I'm going to run out there and get it. So, boom.
You know what I find interesting about this is that Mac users used to belittle Windows for having so many versions, like in the, you know, the Vista era.
Yeah.
But now, if you consider it, Windows has only one more version of their OS than Mac, if you include OS X Server in that.
You're right. And also, if you think about Windows RT as kind of an iOS,
yes,
then you end up with the same paradigm, which means, you know, in some ways they are just copying. But I think they also got the message. No one wants to be that confused about. And the thing is, with some, like with Windows, you know, Starter, Home Basic, Home Premium, people were confused as to what applications they could drive on it. It sounds like Windows 8 and Windows 8 Pro, those are 64-bit operating systems wholly. ARM doesn't do 64-bit yet, to my knowledge. So Windows RT, I think one of the reasons that it's not really going to support a lot of apps, a lot of programs, is because, you know, it's focused on this sort of legacy 32-bit world, but it's doing that for the sake of saving power, which is powerful.
Yep. All right. Any other notes on this before we move into our final word?
No, I'm good.
All right. Well, let's take a little break here.
Good luck to Microsoft.
Yes. Oh, me too. Yeah, I cannot wait. I'm actually champing at the bit for Windows 8. I've already got the consumer preview loaded on my MacBook, on my Mac Air, and I'm just waiting for that. That's the future home of the full version when it comes out as well. So I can't wait to see it. Let's take a little break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about a interesting proposal, a pledge from Twitter to stay out of the patent wars. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Ain't nothing but against the party. Oh shit, you done fucked up, man. You done put two of America's most wanted in the same motherfucking place at the same motherfucking time. Y'all niggas about to feel this. Break out the champagne glasses and motherfucking condoms. Have one on us, alright? Picture perfect, I paint a perfect picture. Bomber hooches with precision, my tits took you with you with that and double OP. Dog, my fucking homie, you the cold ass nigga on the mall. Showing up, I keep my hand on my gun, cause they got me on the run. Now I'm back in the courtroom, waiting on the outcome. 3-2-5 is all that's on the nigga's mind, but at the same time, it seems they trying to take mine. So I'ma get smart and get defensive and shit, and put together a million march for some gangster shit. So now they got a slate, 2 multi-millionaire motherfuckers catch a case. Bitches get ready for the throwdown, the shit's about to go down. Me and Snoop about to clash. I'm losing my religion, I'm vicious on these stool pigeons. You might be deep in this game, but you got the rules missing. Niggas be acting like you're savage, they out to get the cabbage. I got nothing but love for my niggas living life. I got a pit named P, she niggerina. I got a house out in the hills, right next to Chino. And I
think I got a black Beamer, but my dream is to own a fly casino like Bugsy Siegel and do it all illegal and get scooped up by the little homie in the Riga. It feel good to you, baby bubba. You see, this is for the G's and the keys, motherfucker.
Now follow as we ride, motherfuck the rest. Two of the best from the west side, and I can make you famous. Niggas been dying for years, so how can they blame us? I live in fear of a felony. I never stop bailing me, motherfucking G's. If you got it, better flow it. Another one, two of them every smoke won't.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini, and I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas. How you doing, Dwayne?
I'm all right. Excited.
All right. Now, we've talked endlessly on this show about the patent wars and how it's killing innovation and how it seems like it's an endless, mutually assured destruction and escalation of forces that seems to have no end in sight, since everyone is buying up all these patents and threatening to use them, threatening to use them against each other like a doomsday device. But Twitter this week unveiled a bold new commitment that they're planning to effect into writing, that they will not use any patents derived from employee inventions in offensive lawsuits without the inventor's permission. It's a highly unusual move in the technology industry, which is awash in patent lawsuits filed by and against seemingly all of the biggest companies. They've written up a draft of what they call the Innovators Patent Agreement, or IPA, which encourages its developers to invent without the fear that their inventions will be used for nefarious purposes. Their decision comes a month after a former Yahoo developer complained that Yahoo promised that it would use patents for defensive purposes only to use those patents to sue Facebook. Twitter will put its own promise in writing, theoretically making it a lot more binding than any spoken commitments. They still maintain the right to use the patents for defensive purposes, such as a counterclaim filed to fend off lawsuits launched by others. The VP of engineering, Adam Messenger, wrote in a blog post that Twitter does acquire patents, but they sometimes worry that they may be used to impede the innovation of others. The IPA is a new way to do patent assignment that keeps control in the hands of engineers and designers. It's a commitment from Twitter to our employees that patents can only be used for defensive purposes. So it's essentially like...
This is go ahead.
I was going to say, this is like, you remember when, this is a weird analogy, so bear with me here. When Oppenheimer invented the bomb, yeah, the atomic bomb, and when they succeeded in inventing the bomb, he realized what they had done and what the future of that invention would bring about. And what was that famous quote that he said? I am become
death, destroyer of worlds.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Twitter is essentially saying that we will not become death, the destroyer of worlds.
Destroyer of innovation.
Yeah, destroyer of innovations with our innovators' patent filings.
Yeah, this is interesting because what it does is, this is why I think it'd be great to hear Chris's opinion on this. The whole patent system, again, was designed to, let those inventors reap some reward and also get that invention out there so that the public could see how it was made and stand on the shoulders and build something stuff. That's why we have awesome phones and things like that now. Twitter's putting it back in the hands of the inventors. The whole problem with this stupid patent war craziness is that the patents got out of the hands of long-dead inventors in some cases, or just inventors that, we're like, hey, if someone wants to give me millions of dollars for this, it's my one shot. I'm going to do it. And rightly so. But these people took them, like Lodesys and all these other people. And, it got in the hands of people who didn't have to work for these patents, right? People who managed to aggregate money or get investments or whatever, who didn't actually have to go into the birthing, the hard work, the invention of these wonderful devices and processes and everything. And they got in the hands of these people and they just abused them. Just like you'd abuse, if you didn't know how something worked and it was very powerful, you might abuse it. If you weren't there to go through the cultural inception of it all, then you understand what's going on. It's like when you see someone from a developing country pick up an AK-47. All they know is that it's power. They don't know that it's also like destruction. And I feel like that's a lot of what's been going on. That's where the abuse came from. If you keep this in the hands of the people who do invent, who do like create, who do all these things, then I really feel as if they're going to be so much more responsible with it than the straight up business people who are going to hire people to, you know, leverage the law and use, like, I wouldn't call them loopholes, but you leverage the law in such a way as to profit off of something and stop other people from moving the entire, all of us forward. So this is exciting for me. And I think it's exciting for anyone who really loves technology, because hopefully, I mean, we'll see how powerful this is when it comes to the rubber hitting the road. But yeah, I feel like it's a situation that we can see Twitter and leading it. And as a person who spent a lot of time in the IP world in New York, I feel like it's a pretty interesting concept. And while it's not completely original, it's the first for one of the big companies today saying, "Hey, look. We do dabble in mobile. We have this internet and social thing down, and we're very focused on moving forward. And we don't want to be held back by this nonsense, this petty, you know, switch it up, change around, attack you, attack me, which is key."
Do you think that Twitter's move here is going to make any sort of impact on companies like Microsoft and Google, who have so much invested in the process of patent litigation?
I think that when it comes to the oldies like Apple and Microsoft, I don't think there's going to be a lot of movement here. Google, Facebook, there may be some movement, but they're already so involved in stuff, you know, that they can't exactly back out and pick up this stance. Maybe they can use it going forward. I guess Facebook is in a defensive position. They have to use this counterclaim situation against Yahoo. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, Twitter is uniquely young. I could see a Foursquare jumping on this. I could see some other guys jumping on this. And it's uniquely young and vibrant and growing. And it's always changed the game. We never thought a social network could be based on 140 character, like, you know, text pushes. So it's as inventive as the entire concept, I guess.
You know what? I'll tell you what I feel like is also a major difference here, is that Twitter doesn't – none of their patents affect any physical devices in the way that Google or Microsoft with the, you know, Android hardware does. I mean, when you're talking about patents that where the licenses for the patents should be applied towards – thousands and thousands of individual devices. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money on the table to be leaving on the table. Whereas Twitter doesn't have that sort of investment involved.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a lot easier to make some software than it is to make some hardware. It's a lot easier to make software to have a couple people sit around and code things out. But a lot of what we're seeing with the patent lawsuits that we've come across are software patents. Things like mouse operating system or slide to unlock. These are software patents that are being used in these cases. So I feel like Twitter's basically laying the groundwork to say, you know, in the future, when the leadership is changed, it's still up to the inventor to decide whether or not they could go after anybody with these patents.
Yeah, I think you're right. But good for them. I mean, I hope that they set some sort of example that others will follow. And if not the old guard, if not the the Apples and the Microsofts and the Google, maybe, as you said, the up and coming companies will adopt something like this. One last point about this: Instapaper's founder Marco Arment wrote that. That he feels like this is like a duct tape to patch a broken system, that the ideal, a truly innovative stance would be for a large technology company to avoid filing patents and to lobby aggressively for progressive patent reform to make that a practical choice for every technology company.
I mean, I think that's kind of pie in the sky. Twitter, let's make Twitter's position clear. We're not going to chase you down with our patent and try to sue you if you copy something that we do, unless the inventor wants to. But we have these patents. In case someone attacks us, we can use them truly defensively. And you can't defend yourself if you don't have the patents of things you've invented. And that's where I think Mark Arment is incorrect. You need to have a shield in this particular day and age. So did they go all the way to the White Knight? No, but they're closer than anybody else, and there's no aggression in there. They're truly doing this whole do no evil thing. That's what they're focused on. So I feel like I get his ideal. I don't think this precludes Twitter from saying, hey, let's lobby against the patent system as it is and see what we can do to make them expire more quickly or something. That said, I do think we need patents in order to move forward. Patents are, I'll say it. I said it once, sitting in patents are really, really powerful in terms of us understanding how stuff is made so we can make better stuff. It's just a question of crediting the people correctly and not having to pay out the wazoo just for doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an ongoing thing, of course, and I think this is a major milestone in the patent war timeline. And hopefully, we'll see how this bears out in future generations. I think that's it, though, for this episode. Unless you have anything else that you wanted to bring up or talk about.
No, I'm gonna. There was one last thing. Mm-hmm. I guess a headline, but it's very attached to this. A judge. And I think a European court has basically gotten Tim Cook and the head of Samsung, I'm sorry, I don't know his name, to get together and talk about this whole nonsense patent stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's the first time that these people at this level will be able to deal, been dealing with this huge situation, So who knows what will happen? Tim Cook is not Steve Jobs. Tim Cook never vowed to destroy Android.
Yes. Yes. So maybe this is a time for hands to reach across the water there and cooler heads to prevail and no mutually assured destruction.
Exactly. And these companies, they rely on each other so much that it's a shame to see them. It's great that you can see people disagreeing and still working together.
Uh-huh.
As is the case with Apple and Samsung. But they'd get more done if they just work together. So, if they could come to some kind of sort of agreement, that'd be great. We'll follow that, and I'll make sure that I send you the link, Andy, so you can put it on the show notes of this.
Oh, terrific. Well, it's all about the Benjamins, basically.
That is true.
It's the bottom line. All right, Dwayne, where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
All right, you can find me on flavors.me/Dwayne D. That's DWAYNED. You can also find me on Twitter at Twitter/ Dwayne D. And you can always find me here on the Drill Down. I'm happy to be here. And, it's been great. Sam Boyd, I hope it wasn't too much Dwayne for you.
There's never too much Dwayne for me. As for me, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. gplus.to/MrBabyMan, where you can find my Google Plus links, which has all my social media profiles as well. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. We're located there on the right-hand sidebar at the very top. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. You could sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com, or just post a, write a reply in our Geeks of Doom podcast show notes entry. If you got a viewpoint on any stories we talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location, when we will hopefully have a little bit more of our esteemed panel online. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, everybody. See you next week.